die, Father, is nothing left. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact right. And that is why you are here.
And before known history, to the unknown future, this is Release Radio. For the Seeker.
I must strive to know.
That's right, you're listening to Red Ice Radio, headquartered on the west coast of Sweden. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and all of us at Red Ice are, as always, glad that you're here and interested in listening and learning more about many of the subjects that we find worth spending some time on. Please see redicecreations.com for more independent investigations into cover-ups, controversies, and conspiracies. This is a radio program that covers a lot of different subjects, many of these others won't even touch, and some of these you might not even like. Well, we're not afraid to look into the claims in order to get a better understanding of many of the fringe subjects that are floating around in these strange and confusing times. The truth and the claims of what the truth is will lead us where it may. We take the opportunity to hear about it and investigate it for ourselves, all to be able to make up our own minds, just as we hope that it will aid you to make up yours. Harry Hubbard has written, arranged, directed, and produced over 20 videos for Alexander Helios, focused on various archaeological sites. He has also written several non-fiction books, reports, and articles concerning the archaeological discovery in Marion County, Illinois. Harry is with us to discuss the intriguing and bizarre story of the Illinois Caves, first discovered in spring 1925 by a local resident, Orville Lowry, of Hickory Hill, in the southeast corner of Marion County in Illinois. In the first hour, Harry tells us the story of how this discovery unfolded, the characters involved, and how he arrived on the scene. Harry and fellow researchers were able to amass large quantities of information from the artifacts as to who the people were that constructed the Illinois Mystery Cave, and the identities of the corpses who lay interred within it. These claims are profound and does not only challenge the mainstream archaeological community, but also brings to the surface yet again the suppression of ancient America's true history. Harry Hubbard, welcome. Thank you for coming on the program. I've been watching many of your video presentations here in the last couple of weeks, basically, and I can't wait to talk with you more about your findings today. So first of all, thank you for coming on, talking with us today, Harry.
Thank you.
Now, I know you're struggling a little bit with a cold, and you'll be, of course, very gracious to give us some of your time anyway. So I hope we can make this convenient for you as well today, Harry.
Oh, likewise. Thank
all right. You. Definitely. You bet. Now, why don't we kind of let's introduce you a little bit to this story that we're going to discuss about first. I mean, I think it might be pertinent to go back to 1925 and obviously talk about the finds itself. But just give us briefly, if you will, Harry, a little bit on your background and how you got involved in this story that we're going to talk about today.
I've always been very interested in American antiquities. My father was very interested in ancient civilizations here in North America. He had lived out west, and when I was a child, we would go to different mound complexes, and I had developed a theory that at some point in time, the ancient Romans or peoples from the Mediterranean had come here, and or Phoenicians, Libyans, Egyptians, And of course, the indoctrination of American school is to ponderate that that Columbus was first, that nobody was here before Columbus. And I always thought, well, Columbus got here and met the Indians. So, and then as time drew on, I kind of thought that something happened in the timeline that we were unaware of, that there was a warp in the timeline as far as the history of North America was concerned that we all missed, that there was just something missing because there was just too much evidence of advanced cultures that were here. And it's in every state, all over this country, everywhere. And that this continent was peopled by many thousands and thousands of persons, ancient tribes and civilizations, and the evidence was everywhere. And so later in life, I just kept reading. I love reading, and I've read thousands of books, and just kept all of this in the back of my mind. And I went to look for some of these ancient cultures and try to put some pieces of the puzzle together that made sense to me. And my library was filled with books from the 1800s concerning North American antiquities. And a lot of these scholars that wrote history books in the 1800s, they would start their history books out with the mound builders, whereas they were called United States history books. All the United States history books printed in the 1800s, the first chapters are all of mound builders and ancient civilizations. And then in the early 1900s, we had this new kind of history book come about that was called American history. And the American history books either started with Columbus, the Pilgrims, or the Revolutionary War. And they left out a lot of the information concerning the mound builders and the ancient sun-worshipping cultures, et cetera, et cetera. So many of the writers in the 1800s, they would all postulate that the Carthaginians, that the Phoenicians, that the Romans or some other Mediterranean tribes had been here. And they had come here and the evidence was here. Well, later in life, I was to learn that they all were here, the Celts, the Vikings, the Egyptians, the Romans, the Phoenicians. They were all here. And that was my interest.
Indeed. Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I mean, I don't still really understand why this official story is still going on. We've talked about it on this program many times before. I brought up Vinland when the Vikings came over to basically Newfoundland today. We've talked with people like David Hatcher Childress about the legend of Grand Canyon's Egyptian artifacts and everything else. Mm-hmm. And obviously what we're going to focus on today, Harry, is a different twist to it, but yet it connects with many of these stories as well. Why don't we then backtrack to around 1925 and basically detail of what happened in Marion County here first?
Well, a lot of it starts with David Hatcher Childress. He is a Renaissance man. And I had purchased several of his books, and that is what got me into all this trouble. But to go back to 1925, there was a man who lived in Hickory Hill, Illinois. And this is approximately, you're looking like 11 miles east of Interstate 57 in southeast Marion County, Illinois. And he is out on a piece of property with his two daughters. One of them is 6 and the other one is 4. And he's got his old pickup truck there. And they are picking up stones to make a garden. And back then, a lot of the land was cleared, and they constantly, every year, they'd have to go and pick up stones. Well, I found out later, the stones they were picking up were actually axe heads, arrowheads, spearheads, just by the bucket, by the truckload. And he would take them and dump them. And he was out with his two daughters, and his 6-year-old daughter named Fern, his name was Orville Lowry, Fern Lowry, found a hole on the side of a bluff. There are ravines here. The strata has surfacing sandstone, and the water force over periods of time has cut these rather large ravines. They're 15 to 20 feet deep and 70 to 100 feet wide. And she had found a hole, and her father came over, Orville came over, and he saw some markings, and he saw different things there, and he's like, wow, this is something really nice. So he tried to get the scholars, the archaeologists and scholars involved and interested in it from the local universities, from Carbondale and Champaign-Urbana, and they didn't want to hear of it because they told him that they didn't have any record of anything there. So, which coincidentally, there are mounds all over this area, right where I'm speaking to you from. I'm at a really nice state-of-the-art recording studio called Lost Recording, and this studio is actually on an ancient mound settlement, and they're all around me right now.
Yeah, nice.
And where I actually live, I live on a ridge that is that people have inhabited for thousands of years. And so Orville was just perturbed that no one was interested in it. But then in the 1930s, the late 1930s, President Roosevelt's New Deal was a program called WAPA, Work Project Assistance or something like that. And they would hire one person in a township to record local history. And so Orville got his story into some type of WAPA papers, but it was actually entered into the courthouse. Well, there was, 35 years later, in 1961, one of the America's premier treasure book writers named Michael Paul Henson, he went from town to town researching ghost towns, and he knew how to go to these courthouses of these little county seats and look up the records and find ghost towns or where places used to be of activity and such. And he discovered Orville Lowry's story. At that time, Orville Lowry lived in a village south of us called Mount Vernon. Actually, Mount Vernon, all of these towns around here that are called Mount Vernon, Mount Erie, they're all built on ancient mounds. And Mount Vernon, actually, is called the King City because that's where a king was on the ancient mound when the white people came. So he got up with Orville Lowry, and Orville Lowry actually took him to the site. Orville was so excited, he called his daughter and said, wow, you know, this guy's actually interested. He's like 35 years down the road. So Orville was very happy to get his story into a treasure book. And then subsequently, it was recorded in other treasure books. Orville, unfortunately, died in 1974. And as metal detectors became more popular here in the United States, there was more interest in the treasure books and the treasure guides. And so people would buy a metal detector and they would get as a bonus a free treasure book. And so what essentially happened in 1982 is a man purchased a metal detector and correlated. He was presented with one book when he bought the detector, and then he bought another treasure book. Well, the same site was listed in both treasure books from different directions. So he correlated them, and he had a good idea where this hole was. And it said in both of the treasure books that Orville believed gold had been there, because there were gold traces or nuggets or size that that there was gold nearby or something. Mm-hmm. So be it in the creek or something like that. So in first week of April 1982, he ventured into the area here, and one of the local ladies and her husband escorted him down to this ravine system. And then he found the hole that same week, and then he had no more contact with the people who escorted him down there. And it was his discovery pretty much stayed on the back burner until 1991, when he and another author co-wrote a book together, and it was called Mystery Cave of Many Faces. And he had been pulling out artifacts by the hundreds, by the thousands, and they're just amazing artifacts. And they all had scripting on them, or many, many of them had archaic writing on them. And the scholars called it all a hoax because, number one, he wouldn't take them to the site. He wouldn't tell them where it was at, and they couldn't decipher the script. And come to find out, many of the scholars who were attempting to decipher the script, they were trying to read it backwards. There was a mindset here with our academia that all things are written from left to right. So that's how they were trying to write it, read it. And it's written from right to left, mostly. And it's also written back and forth. Most are feeding. It's written up. It's written down. One tablet will be up from the bottom. Then you flip it over. Then it's read up from the from the other side. So so in 1994, my friend Paul, who's also in all the videos, he busted this script. It was an archaic form of Latin, borrowing Punic characters, and the story that they told is just absolutely amazing. And that's one of the things that I'd like to go into during your second hour, is actually what the artifacts say and what they talk about. And I think that if we keep this segment pretty much central in on the story and what happened to us, and as everything unfolded, then we'll get back to the artifacts later.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like a good idea. I wanted to backtrack just briefly here to make sure we got some of the names right. When we were back in 1982 there, we're talking about Russell Burroughs, correct? Which is, you know, obviously where the cave's been named after, as we consequently know them, the Burroughs Caves. Is that correct?
It's known in some circles as the Burroughs Cave. We prefer to call it the Lost Tomb, or other people have dubbed it the Illinois Caves. That's how we are on Facebook and Twitter, the Illinois Caves. Our website is called IllinoisCaves.com. And so we don't call it Burroughs Cave. I don't mention that in any of our books. But yeah, it was known before we came along as a Burroughs Cave.
Yeah, that's right. There was a long time here, obviously, when it was largely, as far as we know anyway, Harry, undiscovered. No one knew about it from the time of Orwell, then up to Burroughs, basically. Do you think that anything happened during that time? Was there any kind of looting going on or anything like that?
Before Russell Burroughs got in it, no. I do not believe that there was any looting going on at all. And after Russell Burroughs started removing artifacts and gold pieces, there's some silver pieces that we have a record of also. And he did pull and remove and gain tremendous profit off of sales of artifacts, off of melting down gold pieces. And a little more discretion would have been much appreciated. However, if he had just taken pictures of the artifacts, and he could have sold the pictures and made as big a fortune just selling the pictures.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen. So it's good in one way, bad mostly. But he did bring out the artifacts that we were able to sift through, and Paul pulling out alphabetic characters and then phonetically deciphering the tablets And the story that they told was just incredible. And so I can tell you that story. We can go back and answer more questions.
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, let's just kind of carry on here, obviously, in the timeline a little bit, if you will. As far as I know, the most important time here for you when you got involved, Harry, is around 1995, correct? How did you so tell us about how you finally got into this then with the cave and everything?
I first spoke to I was speaking to David Hatcher Childress, I believe it was in 92, because I was really fascinated with his books, and he had written about Burroughs Cave, and he recommended some other books and articles about Burroughs Cave, which I purchased. And I really wasn't prepared at the time to purchase Fred Riedholm's book because it was very expensive. And I said, well, let's find out a little bit more. So I ended up buying David Hatcher's books and some of the other stuff, and then eventually got the Mr. Cave Many Faces. And I was just shopping through David Hatcher Childress's World Explorers catalog, and David Hatcher Childress described a lot of the stuff and had some handwritten drawings of some of the artifacts, and it was all pretty good, and I spoke to him about it, and he was very knowledgeable. He's a very nice fellow, and so I pretty much developed a rapport with him back in, I guess it was 92 or 93, and it was in I guess 93 that I met Paul. Yes. And then we did the map video in winter of 1994. And I was speaking to Burroughs. We spoke to Burroughs, I guess it was summer of 93 first. We wanted more information. Paul was interested in it. I was very interested in it because anything North American antiquities was right up my lane, and I was just into it. And there is no more information. You can buy this book. You can get this book, and I don't have any more pictures. I don't have any more artifacts. I'm really at a loss. I can't help you out. And so, which we later grew to know that was not the case at all. Hmm. And but he was all ready to sell me plenty of artifacts. So I started purchasing artifacts from him, and that was in summer of '94. Paul busted the script in June of 1994, after we had made the Laseria map collection video. And we spoke to Burroughs, and that's pretty much where book one starts to really pick up on, and all the things that happened and all the things that Burroughs did to us, even at the initial dawning stages of all this.
Do you care to enlighten our listeners who don't know about this a little bit? What happened there?
A lot of trauma. He gave my 800 toll-free line to dozens and dozens of people, and the phone was just ringing off. I had it set up to sell CDs. I'm a music publisher and producer, and plus I do other things as well, and I had a large electric motor shop, rewinding shop, machine shop, and I had my 800 line coming into one of my offices to sell CDs from like Ted Neely, Michael Rapp, Glass Hammer, and to take orders and to do shipping, and the phones were just off the hook, and we just told everybody, hey, you know, leave us alone. We had no idea that Burroughs was going to do that to us, and that was just at the very, very beginning. And when I told him, man, I don't appreciate you giving everybody our 800 number, he just laughed at me in my face over the phone. Just, we had no idea at the time who we were dealing with or what we were dealing with. And so a year later, in 1994, is when Paul broke the script. We started piecing together the story, and we made our first decipherment tape in summer of 94. And after that video was done, I had contacted Burroughs and said, you need to see this. We've got the decipherments for you to see. I've got the videotape here, and you can watch it. So we set a date for September of 94. And before I left, I was building a studio in Chattanooga with my Glass Hammer buddies. And before I left, he tried every excuse in the world to keep me from coming up there to show him this video. And if I was him and I'd made a discovery, I want to see somebody decipher the tablets. I would have, I couldn't, we couldn't understand, you know, why he was so evasive, you know, and this and that. So finally we sketched in a date. I drove up to Illinois, Olney, which is a town about 45, 50 miles away from here. And I stayed in a hotel there, and I set up my video machine, and he came over, and he watched the video, and it freaked him out. Freaked him out really, really bad.
You know why?
You tell me. He jumped up, and he was grabbing his face, pacing the floor, going, when the decipherment came in on the screen that put it all together, Bas Achilles Upelia, it was King Alexander of Pella. And he just freaked out. He put his hands over his face and started playing, sweating bullets, going, oh my God, what have I done? Oh my God, what have I done? What have I done? And when I'm like, you know, I grew up in Armurchie, Georgia. I'm like, well, ain't he happy? You know, it's like, he should be happy. he found an ancient Macedonian tomb from Egypt that people's been looking for 2,000 years. and he was just freaking out. And that's what the whole story was about. And that's what happened. And involved with all this is everything you could imagine if anywhere in the world someone had found the crypt of the Ptolemaic dynasty. In his book, Mr. K. Many Faces, and also in the Shears book, Rock Art Pieces from Burroughs Cave, Burroughs describes a series of crypts in the man-made cavern system. And he accessed it near or through the hole that was found in 1925. And there were 12 crypts. One of them had a woman in it. The others were all male. And way in the back, and far in the back, he had rolled back a large stone, and inside it there was a man interred in a solid gold coffin. And this is what he writes. And it's hard for somebody to make up that kind of stuff. You just don't make up, hey, I found an ancient king buried in a gold coffin. Well, that does narrow it down a bit, because there aren't that many ancient kings buried in solid gold coffins.
It's a very strange kind of way that obviously, you know, Russell acts and what happens here. And I'm still trying to, you know, struggle a bit as to why. But, you know, let's just shift over a little bit. And for audience who've never heard about this story before, kind of give them a little bit of a chronology of what we think we know today about exactly who it is, what the evidence is for who it is, and how we got there. We could back up 2,000 years, if you so will, Harry. Yeah.
All right. So what happens is after the Battle of Actium, Mark Antony and Cleopatra basically flee, or the wind blows, or so many theories about that, but they go back to Alexandria. Now, it took Octavian and his army, because they were marching over the land of the Hellespont and down through Syria, Tyre, the eastern Mediterranean coast. It took him about a year to get there, because he knew that Mark Antony and Cleopatra weren't going anywhere. So by the time he got there, it was like a year later. And during that time, that span of 1 year, there are all kinds of things that took place. And we have to look at Queen Cleopatra, Queen of Queens. She was absolutely brilliant. And it had to have been her idea. Now, at this time, she had 3 children by Mark Antony. And Helios and Selene, the sun and the moon, which were twins. And then she had little baby Philadelphus, who was like 5 or 6 years younger than they were. So she got the bright idea, we believe, to whisk the family Sema out of Alexandria. Now, how she did it, we're not sure. She could have taken the ships, lots of the gold or whatever, and gone to the, taken it to the Red Sea, and then gone south around the Horn of Africa, and then come up to back into Iberia, Spain, Cadiz, and or she could have gone through the Mediterranean Sea. We do have evidence. It's speculation at this time. We're not sure. But if she'd gone through the Mediterranean Sea, my theory is that it would have had to have been ships, and they would have had to constantly change flags. Some of the ships on these stones, the flags are different. And they could have sailed to a certain point under like a Roman flag, then put up this kind of flag, this kind of flag, and other in order to evade detection. And from there, sailed over to North America. Now, what she did was, is she pulled up all of the family mausoleum, the SEMA that was in the mausoleum. That is all of the bodies, the cadavers of her ancestors. All right, from Ptolemy Soter the First all the way down to her father, Ptolemy the pipe player. Excuse me, Aletes Teba. Her father, and just whisked them all up and got them on a ship. Now, sometime later, her son, Alexander Helios, did get her body and take it also. So, at the time, there was a lot of sacrifice. There was a lot of persecution. Octavian persecuted a lot of Mark Antony's soldiers, and they didn't want to they did not want to serve under Octavian. They thought he was a wimp. So here Octavian's got, 50,000 soldiers that he does not want to try to control. So it looks like 50,000 people came over here at one whack. And the featured cadaver in the crypt of the Ptolemies was Alexander the Great. But he wasn't the Great then. He was Alexander of Pella. And he was the actual initiator of the Ptolemaic dynasty, such that Philip II, King Philip, who's Alexander the Great's father, gave Lagus, Ptolemy Soter the First's father, his favorite concubine, and she was pregnant at the time. So that was Ptolemy Soter. So Alexander the Great and Ptolemy Soter the First were actually half brothers. And so from that, a lot of people all over the world are making a lot of money looking for Alexander the Great's body or his entombment.
Sure.
Without ever giving it any thought whatsoever that they were all buried together. They were all buried. And we've been out on this limb now for 19 years. Next month or so, it'll be initiating the 20th year that we have been saying that Alexander the Great, the entire Ptolemaic dynasty, including Queen of Queens, Cleopatra, are all interred right here in Marion County. And no one the world over has proven anything other. And all the evidence just seems to keep coming up more and more and more and more so.
It's an amazing claim, and we'll obviously get into the details of this here. And let's just try to answer this first. Why did they end up in Illinois?
They were lost. there's a massive river system that goes through the central part of this country. You go up the Mississippi River, and where the Mississippi River, which bisects the country here, you go up the Mississippi River, you come to the Ohio River. Where they meet, the Ohio River is like twice as wide as the Mississippi. So they just made an easterly turn, and they went up the Ohio River for, 100, 120 miles maybe or so? And then they come to another large river called the Wabash River today, and it's got ancient settlements. All these rivers have ancient settlements, thousands of them on both sides of the riverbanks. They went up the Wabash River, then they turned, went westerly up the Little Wabash River, and then they went up the Skillet Fork River, and then basically up the Lick Branch. And we don't know what these rivers looked like back then.
Yeah.
But Illinois, coincidentally, is 4/5 natural boundaries surrounded by rivers. Now, Illinois has the Mississippi River on one side, the Ohio River on the other side. In the boundary of Illinois, you have the Illinois River. The Missouri River comes to the western side of Illinois. You also have the Wabash River, and along with that, the Tennessee and the Cumberland River are all right in the vicinity of Illinois. There is no other state that has so many of our large, it has every large, all the largest rivers of our country either border or make the border of Illinois.
Hmm.
And there was a lot of game here. I'm sure there's all kinds of nut trees and there's lots of fruits and stuff. And the latitude, the way the stars look, is somewhat similar to what you would see in the northern Mediterranean area there.
Yeah. So they basically fled, right? That's the first thing we need to clarify, though. They decided to get out, and as far as we know, so I've understood the story as well, they knew where they were going because of their relationship to King Juba II, correct?
Well, as Pliny records, King Juba II was a master of the Atlantic Ocean. He knew the Mediterranean and the Atlantic better than anyone. And so we'll get more into artifacts and what they say about him a little bit later.
Yeah.
But yes, the five people who are mostly responsible for what happened here are Queen of Queens, Cleopatra, Octavia, Octavian's sister, King Juba II, Selene, and Alexander Helios. So three women and two men. And with Juba's knowledge and his maps, I'm sure he directed them exactly where to go. And there is the possibility that he did actually sail over here. There was commerce back and forth. We can see that there was commerce within these the artifacts. There was trade. There was probably copper loaded back and forth, and you know. It was no secret. It was just a land that was far away. It's what, 21 days sail to get here. And evidently they went back and forth.
Hmm. Yeah, transcultural diffusion, as they call it, seemed to have been commonplace the further back you go. And with the Phoenician seafarers and their knowledge of the seas and everything else, it definitely seems to have been passed down to consequent people. And there was large knowledge about, you know, the Americas at that point, and then either we're talking about an effective cover-up later in history, or because of circumstances, they forgot this or neglected this, and we can certainly, you know, talk about that later if we need to. But let's talk about the location, I guess, of the caves and the layout. I mean, you've been there yourself how many times, Harry?
Oh, I live 3 miles from it, so 3.5 miles or so. And I have not been inside it. I do not have permission to go inside it. We did our earth resistivity tests, and we found there's two large ravines. One of them has a cavern system in it, and the one to the west has a large room underneath the ground about 10 feet. And my hands are tied because the owner of the property wants to sell the land. And whoever buys it can, you know, own your own Egyptian tomb full of the most famous kings and queens in all of history.
Does the owner know this?
Oh, yeah. I kept him totally abreast years ago. In the state of Illinois, if you find something on someone's property and then you purchase that property later without notifying that owner, then they can get their land back. It's some kind of truity clause or something. In other words, if you go and you know there's oil on somebody's property, and then you buy the mineral rights to it for real cheap, and then you go and put up a well that's pumping 300 gallons a day of oil, well, you know, he can come back and say, oh, you know, this and that. So it was always my intent to be above board on everything.
Does the owner recognize this? Has he explored this himself? How much in communication are you with him? It can be her, of course, as well.
He does not appear to be that interested. Now,
really?
There
wow.
is some discrepancy because the History Channel had told me that he's a big fan of their show. So and he's going to let them on his property. And I told him, I said, you know, this is the best way to get the money that you want. He wants an exorbitant amount of money for the property.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which is okay. You know, it took me over $800,000 to figure out exactly what it was through the years. And if somebody else came back that even had near that much, you know, I just ran out. You know, I got tapped clean, but I had to. You know, people say, well, that was stupid. You know what? You have to do that. When you make a discovery of this magnitude, you have to follow through with it. You have no choice. Your fate is sealed. My fate is sealed. And that's why we, for 20 years or so, that we've been saying this, Paul and I are either the biggest fools that ever walked this planet, or we do have the IQs. We have been well read. We do know these ancient languages. We have done our homework. In the meantime, as I have said before, no one the world over has proven us wrong at all.
Now, if you don't mind me asking, then do you know how much he actually wants for the property?
Yeah, it was $1 million.
$1 million.
Yeah, which isn't that out of the way here, you know? I mean,
considering what the potential might be here, but isn't it weird that he wants money for the property, but he doesn't seem to be that interested in what's actually there then?
Well, his contention is, Harry, if I let you on that property and you don't find it, which to me is a non-issue, he said, then I can't get my price for it. As long as Harry Hubbard says that tomb is right there, that land is worth something. That's his contention, which is it's his. He bought it, so, you know.
So it's a kind of a little deadlock situation here, basically.
He bought it in the year 2000, and I had met him, and I had known him 5 years previous to that. And he knew exactly what we were doing out there. Because I used to have a lease on the property. He knew exactly what we were saying. And when it came up for sale, he bought it. He's a wealthy man. He's not worried about the price of gas. So
let's talk about what has been found so far. And if there's any, I mean, who has been in there and what have they found, basically, at this stage?
Russ Burroughs pulled out that we know of, it looks like about 1,100 to 1,200 pounds of gold. He has also pulled out that I have seen with my own eyes probably about 3,500 artifacts, some big, some small, some huge, some tiny, a myriad of subjects, statues, medallions, silver coins, you name it. Just everything that you would expect to find in the Ptolemaic crypt with Queen Cleopatra. That's how her name is spelled on the tablets, Cleopatra. It's not Cleopatra, it's Cleopatra, which a modern-day forger probably wouldn't have known, you know. So, and just... There's been artifacts found all through this area, about a mile and a half from where this tomb is located in a creek bed. Oh, about 10 years ago, a guy was out with his buddy, and he found a staff head, the head that goes on the top of a wooden staff, like a king's staff. He found one of those in the creek, pristine piece. I mean, beautiful piece. And there have been people that have found through the years all kinds of Egyptian amulets, elephant carvings of lion figurines in the mounds here. And this entire area, coincidentally, is called Little Egypt. And why it's called Little Egypt, nobody really knows, but I'm thinking it may be some Mennonite boy years and years ago, back in the 1800s, probably found an artifact with Egyptian hieroglyphs on it. Who knows?
Well, there's been a lot of those finds, allegedly. One article I was going through before we began talking here today is these very much, I mean, it looks like Anubis pretty much holding a staff, and there's writing next to him, these gold, you know, artifacts. And I'm also trying to just figure out here, is the photographs of all these artifacts that you show both in your videos and that's available on the websites and everything else, is this done by Burroughs, or who's been doing all the photography here?
That's me.
That's you.
I take the best artifact pictures that I've ever seen. And the other scholars, they say the same thing, but I go to great pains. All of the ones with the blue background are mine. All of the artifacts with the red background are Virginia Horrigan's. And there are other people who have taken some good pictures of the artifact. But the color might not be wrong. You can't see all the characters. When I see an artifact, I want that artifact to be the correct color, and I want to be able to see every character on it. And some of the artifacts, granted, are just too large. You can't do it. You can't get a close-up of everything all in one picture, even if it's 15 megs. It's just hard to do because there's a slope on many of the artifacts. And it's just very difficult.
And so these, the ones that you've shot with the blue background, they are artifacts that you've bought from Russell then, correct?
Some of them are from other people's collections. Most of them are from other people's collections that I've met through the years. And then there are people, I've had many myself. I've been wheeling and dealing in these artifacts now for what, almost 20 years, and I lost 15 artifacts in a disastrous fire, and some of the alien artifacts. That's what I liked mostly, but I've still got 4 or 5 pieces, big nice pieces, and some of my friends here in the local area. There are probably in the local area here over 200, 250 owned by different people.
Yeah.
And then there are other people that own hundreds of this and that. There's only, I believe, one collection that I don't have full photographs of.
So there's a lot of different people out there who has, throughout the years, it's changed hands perhaps, it's been bought and sold, etc. Is there any idea at this stage who... have someone trying to like index it all? I mean, I guess that's something that you've been trying to do, to just get a scope of how much we're talking about, how many artifacts, how many different coins, etc.
Yes, we tried. That was one of the first things we wanted to do back in 1994. But Burroughs had told people, his buyers, that if he had anything to do with Paul and Harry, that he would stop selling them stones. Don't have anything to do with them. Don't have anything to do with them. And so his main buyers, who had these massive collections, they wouldn't let us see any of their pictures. They wouldn't send us pictures. They wouldn't let us. They wouldn't let me photograph their stones or anything, because they were scared to death that Burroughs was going to cut them off from artifact sales. And we told them at the time, back in 1995, we told everybody, stop buying the artifacts. In summer of 1994, after Burroughs saw the video, I told him, I said, now you need to stop selling artifacts. Oh, no, 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 I got to sell, I got to make money. And right after I told him not to sell any artifacts, and he'd been telling us that he had no artifacts, he brought in my room, my hotel room, probably 10 boxes full of just beautiful pieces. I mean, beautiful pieces, incredible artifacts. I bought a Carrara marble bust of Julius Caesar. Does anyone want Julius Caesar on the stone? Yule Caesar. That's where we get the modern day word Caesar. just incredible art. He had an Octavian tablet. He had a couple of Cleopatras. Just amazing stuff. So as we did more decipherments and Burroughs was able to watch and study our videos, we told people to stop buying the artifacts because Burroughs now knows enough to fake them or to start adding to them or tainting them, and that's what he was going to do. He told me he was going to do it, and that's what he did. The artifacts purchased by these people after summer of 1995 have all been tainted. So there is a large portion of these artifacts that have been tampered with, forged, and that is something that does cloud the issue, so to speak.
Well, indeed. Does Burroughs or anyone else, as far as you know, have anyone been granted access to the property to get into the caves by the owner at this point, or has it pretty much been no one is allowed in after year 2000 when he bought it?
No, we had finished. We were in the middle of doing some testing when the property was purchased, and there has been some people, pot hunters, out there digging, scratching around. There's some people that have put some videos up online. That are just really shoddy, just, you know, child's play stuff. But no, there's not been a serious dig since I left it in 96. But I had leased the property just south of where we actually ended up determining that it was.
Well, that's a big problem. And again, I mean, there's so much more of this we need to talk about here. Harry, we'll get into the sure. What's on the artifacts, and obviously the writing is a specific part to all of this that we need to discuss. But what could unlock the situation so that something could begin to move a little bit here? What do you think?
Somebody coming up and buying the property.
That's it.
All it takes. Yep. Somebody buys the property, it's a done deal. 2 days later, they are a multi billionaire. It would take about two or three days to get in. What we believe happened is that as Burroughs was been extremely evasive and adamant about not letting anybody in there, whatever. Our theory at this point is that perhaps the entrance that he was using collapsed because the soil here has a lot of clay in it. And you dig a hole, it's going to eventually just collapse it on top of itself. And as he removed the stone entrance, the stone blocks at the entrances of each one of the crypts, then eventually a massive flood like we had just a few days ago would cause the whole thing to flood out, and probably most of it has been destroyed. He was talking about scrolls being down there and ancient papyri. Well, now they would have all been destroyed or turned to paper, to dust, to ash. Who knows? And all of that would have been gone. All of that. And the funny thing is that according to the classical historians, there was a book at the foot of Alexander's cadaver when he was displayed in Alexandria. And in that book, all of the notables that visited his tomb signed the guest book. And I had asked Burroughs back in the mid-90s, do you remember any kind of book or scroll being in the main crypt? This is back before we even told him who it was. Oh, yeah, there was a book there. Yeah, there was something there. Had a bunch of funny writing in it. What would a book be worth that had the signatures of Pompeii, all of the Roman Republic consuls, Octavian, Julius Caesar, Mark Antony? What would Julius Caesar's autograph be worth today?
Quite a bit.
And or Queen Cleopatra, or all the Cleopatras and Bernie, and all of the Sodors. All of the Ptolemies. What would a book that had all of these autographs what would it be worth? The sky's just, it would be priceless, absolutely priceless. And that probably got destroyed.
Well, that's a damn shame, obviously, if that's the case here. And
speculation.
Sure. What has been the academic response, if any, to these claims and the work you and that you've been doing over the years now?
From what country? United States or abroad?
Anywhere.
Okay, United States, these guys, they don't really know that much. American scholarship is really down the tubes. There's nothing there. This is all strictly mainframe institutionalized. There's very few people that think outside the box. Modern archaeology here are people that go to college for 15 years and they go buy a spatula and dig up arrowheads out in the field. I'm serious. But now abroad, we have been accepted much more widely.
Why is that, do you think?
It's pretty obvious, man. I'd call it ignorance with a capital I. They're so locked into their dogmas of Columbus first. They don't want to hear Scott Walter on the History Channel talk about the authenticity of the Kensington Runestone. Yeah. They don't want to hear Scott Walter talking about all the history that we've been taught is wrong, which he's right. He's kicking butt and taking names, and he's really foraging it. And Scott Walter's a friend of mine, and he told me, you know, when I was visiting with him, he goes, Harry, I've kicked that door down. I've kicked that Columbus first door down. All you got to do now is push it and, you know, walk right through it. And it's a little bit difficult. When you're trying to change history, academic history in North America, you have no scholarly friends. You have no friends.
Yeah.
They're scared to death to touch it.
We've seen it in the past. People like L.A. Waddell.
Exactly.
What's his name now? The other guy who discovered the—I forget his name. There's lots of these older, you know, if you go back 100 years or so, that I've done some tremendous work on many of these sites, of course, and consequently, it's been covered up. And I can't help to think, Kerry, that there is an active cover up potentially part of this as well. We've talked quite extensively in the past about the Smithsonian's involvement in. Not recognizing the giant skeletons that's found around America, but also other parts of the world. So could that be something here? They're trying to just keep the lid
all
on?
All giants are found all over. They've got small people all over. I can show you cities carved in the cliffs out in New Mexico and Arizona where the doorways are like 18 inches tall. And it's not just one or two. It's like hundreds of them. All right. And they just suppress anything. There have been ancient coins, Alexander coins, Roman coins, all found all over this country. They're now finding Egyptian hieroglyphs all over the coast of Canada. And it's just a big wash. And I was glad to hear you mention L.A. Waddell because he is one of my heroes. And his alphabet tables were essential in deciphering these tablets.
Yeah. Yeah. Barry Fell, that was one of the other guys I was thinking about too. We're going to take a break here in a little bit, Harry, but give us just a little tidbit of some of the things that have been found, the carvings on the stones before we take a break, and some of your favorite ones. Some very interesting creatures are showing up on some of these stones. What is that?
You name it. My favorites, I guess, got to be the beautiful naked women, of course. but there's dozens of those. Unbelievable that you can carve on a black rock a woman and get facial features and body figures so accurate and so good without any mistakes. These artifacts have no boo-boos. There's not like I can barely draw a picture on a piece of paper with a pencil and get it all perfect the first time. And many of these artifacts have thousands and thousands of lines, tiny little lines, and they're all perfect. Perfect. These artisans were just incredible. And there are all kinds of everything from birthdays to greeting cards, science tablets, history tablets. There's tablets that appear to be some type of ancient form of music, but we don't know. And there's some kind of Carthaginian numbering system that runs throughout these tablets, which we don't understand. And there are tablets that are that like it might be an Egyptian syntax using Latin characters. You may have a Greek god in Latin characters. You may have a script with Punic, Greek, and Latin, just the different characters. They wrote as they spoke, and they used whatever. They knew everything. You know, they people from the Mediterranean, the common people, they would speak in whatever language that they came from, and only the upper echelons actually were literate enough to read and write. Same with Egyptian, same with the Catholic priest in Latin. It was even the Verulamda text from England. Everybody didn't have the ability to read and write, but you may have someone who was an artisan who could carve a rock and carve someone's head and make it. I mean, if the guy came in the room, oh, sure, that's him. That's that guy. But he couldn't read or write. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. How vast do you think the time span is from the different artifacts and objects, and including the writing?
Good question. Because it appears that many of the artifacts were 2,000 years old 2,000 years ago.
So that means that this is a historic treasure to maybe even the people who came there and wanted to preserve it, have it with them pretty much.
A lot of it must have been pilfered out of the library and museum at Alexandria.
Wow. Well, it's a fascinating story, and of course we're going to continue to talk more about this. We are going to discuss the strangeness of the depictions on some of these stones and what could, you know. Well, it has to do with the ancient astronauts again. Yet again, we have to go there because this is what is shown on some of them. We'll talk about this, and of course the language, the decipherment of the writing that's on these stones as well. We'll get there. But Harry, before we stop here then and take a break, let's talk about the websites where people can go to find out more. I want to hear about the titles of your books where people can read more about the story. So please go ahead, Harry.
My first book was titled Ancient Mediterranean Treasure in North America. My second book is titled The Curse of Alexander's Tomb. They are both on ebooks, and they are available at alexanderhelios.com. My website, or mine and Paul's website, is illinoiscaves.com. And there's a lot of information there, a lot of pictures of artifacts, and it is an old website. It came on in 1997, and we've just done nothing but add to it through the years. And it has a lot of articles on there, pro and con. Has a bunch of bios concerning a lot of the people and just some of the most strange things that you would ever imagine people doing or saying or accomplishing. Just unbelievable. And then we're on Facebook that has a lot of traffic on it. And I put up a new gold medallion or something every week or an alien artifact or something, which we'll get into in the second hour. And that is called the Illinois Caves. And I believe that's also the Twitter account. So anything that's put on the Illinois Caves Facebook also transfers into Twitter some way, somehow. That's our computer genius, Zach, at work there. So
very good. I want to say thanks to Zach as well, by the way, who helped us to get in contact with you, Harry. So that's excellent that he could do that.
He's one of your biggest fans.
That's great. Well, it's awesome when we can connect with new people. And I haven't heard actually about your work until Zach contacted me about it. So we really appreciate that he did that. And so again, then here, just to reiterate, illinoiscaves.com and alexanderhelios.com. Please go there, take a look now in the break here before we continue in the next segment here for our members, and look at the pictures, look at the photos. There are some fascinating ones. So stay with us, everyone. We'll be right back with more with Harry. Thank you. second hour, we delve deep into what is depicted on the artifacts, including strange but highly detailed images of humanoids, aliens, UFOs, and more. Harry explains how the language depicted on the artifacts was decoded using L.A. Waddell's groundbreaking technique. Later, Harry continues on the cave saga and his pursuit. We end the hour speaking more about the Ptolemaic dynasty and why they may have fled, ultimately arriving in America. We proceed at redicemembers.com, our members' website. Subscribe for full access. There is much more to the story, and you shouldn't miss it. A membership is only €5 per month. We have subscriptions going from 3 months up to 2 years. Try it out. Support independent radio that 3 times per week gives you updates and new exciting topics. Our aim and focus is, of course, to detail what really is going on in the world and our true but suppressed history. And we'll be back with more in just a few days. Patrick Henningsen is next from 21st Century Wire to talk about the Boston bombings. But right now, more is coming up with Harry Hubbard. Join us on redicemembers.com.